The Guardian.
One of the defining issues of Brexit was the future of Northern Ireland. Will leaving the EU and the creation of a border down the Irish Sea eventually push Northern Ireland out of the United Kingdom and in to a united Ireland? I'm Jonathan Friedland, and throughout August, I'm speaking to some of the UK's most prominent political movers and shakers. This week, I talked to the Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin's Michelle O'Neill, about Brexit, the legacy of John Hume, and working with Arlene Foster. This is Politics Weekly. So I thought we would just begin with something in a way quite personal, which is people have heard the First Minister of Northern Ireland, Arlene Foster, talking a bit about her upbringing and childhood and the influence of her father and what happened to him as the impact that had on her life. And I know that you grew up in a very political family in the years of the Troubles. And just I'm keen to, as an opening question, what impact that had on you and on forming you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was born in 1977, so you're born into the height of conflict. Nearly, it's very sad to say that, but it actually was a normal to grow up in that type of society. I didn't know anything different. But certainly, I think all our life events shape who we are. And for me, growing up in County Tyrone, a lovely part of the world, might I add, I think it was a very challenging time to have your childhood. Poverty was rife, unemployment was so high, and you had the conflict all around us. I grew up as in a Republican family. My father was very active Republican. He was elected actually for Sinn Féin at a time where it was very difficult to be in elected politics here. All those things helped to shape your outlook in life. But in terms of my own family background, you know, just myself and my brother at home and with mummy and daddy, and we're a very tight family, very close-knit family. My home wasn't a very political home, but the politics was all around us. Obviously, daddy was imprisoned as well. So, I mean, all those things have an impact on your life and your perspective. And whilst mummy and daddy would in some sense try to shelter you from those things, the reality is that they were all around me. And that was the life which I grew up. So I suppose those things all have shaped the woman that I am today.
Yes. I mean, you mentioned your father was a former IRA prisoner and the threat of violence would have been all around. You mentioned those raids. How much was fear part of the backdrop for you growing up?
Well, it was a very difficult time. You know, I talked about that this was like a normal because I was born into a society where conflict existed. And, you know, regularly as a young child going to school, you walked through British Army patrols. You had to nearly feel like at times you felt like you were running a gauntlet to get to school. And that was all around us. And yes, as a young child, I can remember being very fearful. I can always remember, and I'll never forget, this was actually one of my earliest memories, was whenever our house was raided. And, you know, myself and my brother, he was 3 years younger than me, and we were only children sitting at the end of our bed and watching our cupboards being pulled out and our drawers being pulled out and our clothes being gone through. And, you know, it was a really, really frightening way to grow up. And you shouldn't have to go through that as a child, but that was certainly my experience.
And was part of the conversation either from your mother or father, or your brother or uncles, not just about the immediate threat and explaining it, but also saying why we're doing this, because we believe in the cause of a united Ireland?
The community, I suppose, that I grew up in and my experience of conflict here was that the British Army, that came to us, it was on our street. So my parents would have been very good at explaining that the situation, of course. It was a time where there was so much discrimination against the community from which I come. And it was part and parcel of your everyday life that actions taken against Republicans, but against the nationalist community actually as a whole, that was very hard for any parent to explain to their child. But our household, I don't want them to have a misperception, our household was a very warm, loving home, but we had all these realities around us in which it was very difficult for any parent to be able to explain. But my daddy was a very progressive man and someone who always knew that politics was the way to go. He always knew that Sinn Féin was the vehicle in which to pursue a united Ireland, and that's certainly where he would have encouraged me to get involved, to be an activist and actually try to do better for my community.
Now, you were just 21 when the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1998. And as I understand it, you were on your way. You were training to become an accounting technician. You were on a different path. And you know, a lot of people hearing what you've just said would have, I think, understood somebody choosing a path away from politics and nothing to do with the conflict in a way. What was it about the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, if indeed that was the prompt, that made you think, I want to get involved in this? And as you did then, start working for Sinn Féin.
Well, it very much was about the promise and the hope for the future. And it was about something better. And, you know, I voted for the Good Friday Agreement because of the principle of consent, that it was the people here alone that would decide the constitutional future. So for me, as a young activist, to be part of that every day, to bring about a United Ireland by purely peaceful means, by, you know, articulating our arguments, by having the debates about things. So for me, the Good Friday Agreement was about hope, it was about the future, and it was about a peaceful way to bring about Irish unity. So I thought that that was such an exciting time for people here, and that promise that we all could feel was something that I wanted to play my part in. And I think then it was just a natural progression that I would want to get involved in the party and work full time at doing that. And it gave me great opportunities to be able to help people in my constituency all around me every day. And that's a powerful thing to be able to do.
When your father, I think, stepped down from Dungannon Borough Council, you won the seat he'd vacated. You then became the mayor in that borough, I think the first woman to do that. And then in 2007, elected to the Assembly. And your career has really been really rapid since then, rising to be the leader of your party in the Assembly in Belfast, and therefore serving as Deputy First Minister, filling a role that had been filled before then by Martin McGuinness. I mean, he was a huge figure in republicanism, became a figure with an international profile. I covered the first stage of the Northern Ireland peace process when I was the correspondent for The Guardian in Washington. And McGuinness was hugely admired by really senior American politicians from President Clinton on down. Those must have felt like pretty big shoes to fill for you.
Absolutely. I had the very good privilege of working with Martin for many, many years. You're right, I was elected to the Assembly in 2007, but my history with Martin goes way beyond that. Martin historically won an MP seat in Mid-Ulster way back in 93, and that was unseating a unionist politician at that time, and it was a huge, huge victory for nationalism. So Martin has been about my area and indeed our home from we were very, very young. So I joined the Assembly in 2007, 4 years later in 2011, Martin appointed me as Minister for Agriculture and Rural Affairs. He went on then second after that in the next term to appoint me as our Health Minister. So I've worked very closely with him and under his tutelage for many, many years, and I'm very glad to have had that privilege, because he was an absolute master at his craft. He was absolutely the most genuine and sincere person that you could ever come across. And then the takeover from him, I mean, that was just immense. Our politics was very much broken. The RHI scandal crashed the institutions, that's the Assembly and the Executive. And Martin took sick, and, you know, God love him, he then had to stand down quicker than what he had planned. He had originally decided to stand down in the May of that year, marking 10 years since the Good Friday Agreement. But he had to stand down sooner because of his ill health. So, yes, it was a big task to take on, particularly given the fact that our politics was so broken. We had two huge elections, which saw the party achieve the highest vote since the Good Friday Agreement. And, you know, it took us 3 years to put the politics all back together again. So that's been no main task. But I think if you chart since I took over from Martin, the politics being broken, you know, 3 years of negotiations, stop start with all of that, you know, it's been a huge journey to come on. But our politics is working again. We have the Assembly and Executive is restored, and that's all a good thing. And I find the role very challenging, but also very rewarding at the same time.
There's an image, it may actually be a caricature, a stereotype about Ireland, and particularly Northern Ireland, that it is a socially conservative place. And yet I noticed that you and obviously your counterpart in the DUP, Arlene Foster, are both women. The president of Sinn Féin is a woman. This idea that somehow, you know, Northern Irish politics in particular is, you know, stuck in the past and has socially conservative attitudes. Is that wrong? Are you and Arlene Foster in a way proof that it's wrong, or is there more to it than that?
Well, I mean, it's hugely significant. I think it's a great thing that we have so many political leaders today compared to years gone by. If you look at the leader of the Alliance Party, Naomi Long, is a woman. Arlene, obviously, is leader of the DUP. Myself, Mary Lou MacDonald, as our president. I'm very proud in terms of being progressive that our party is leading the way. But I do think that society as a whole is changing. It's certainly got a long journey still to travel, but things are changing. If you look at the makeup of our politics, for example, Arlene Foster and myself would have very different views on many things, and the DUP as a party will be a lot more conservative in these things, whereas we would be a lot more progressive. So it's always difficult to manage all these challenges, but I do think that if you look at Ireland as a whole, if someone had said that 10 years ago that same-sex marriage would be, you know, legal, that you would have women's reproductive rights in society, people would have never have guessed that. So Ireland has, as a whole, is changing right across the board and becoming a more modern society, which is obviously a good thing for people. It's more in keeping with the times that we now live in.
And do you think people like you, who do have very strong memories because of your family upbringing that we talked about, have you know, are very deeply connected and have first-hand experience and memories of the period we call the Troubles? Are you in some ways in a minority? Are there people under 40 or you know, and younger still, for whom that is something in the history books, who aren't formed and shaped by it, and for whom it doesn't dominate their politics? I just wonder to what extent this is actually, you know, journalists like me who follow it, somebody like you who grew up with it, whether it's how we see Northern Ireland and Ireland, but not how a new generation sees it.
I'm glad it's the younger generation's experience to not have been through what so many of us did come through. I see it as my job as a political leader. As a matter of fact, all of my adult life has been about the peace process. It's been about how do you embed the peace process? How do you look for something better? How do you bridge gaps? How do you heal the wounds? Because a lot of people have been hurt in the past. And certainly for me, I don't want a situation where my country gets united and we leave people behind, because it has to be United Ireland for everybody who lives here. And that goes right to the core of our politics. So I think the younger generation, yes, they didn't grow up with it, but they're very alert to the discrimination that still exists. They're very alert in terms of the politics and the sensitivities of here. And they're also very alert to the fact that we are now next year entering into the anniversary year of partition, the country being divided. Brexit, COVID-19, time after time, these things are demonstrating the fact that partition has failed everybody. And I think that's the understanding of the uniqueness of here that probably the younger generation have today.
I want to come on to both those things, but we can't let it pass that you and I are talking in the week that John Hume, the former leader of the SDLP, widely considered to be one of the key architects of the peace agreement in Northern Ireland. This is the week of his funeral. You were there. I saw from here the pictures, much smaller affair than it would have otherwise been because of obviously coronavirus and people having to be spaced apart. Just tell us something about what it was like to be there and what it meant to you.
I think the thing that struck me most that morning when I was driving up to Derry for the funeral was that it very much for me signalled this is the start of the end of the era. What I mean by that is, you know, we led Martin McGuinness to rest, Ian Paisley has passed on, and then you have John Hume, and there are three people who, you know, all different politics, but all people who in one shape or other have played a role in our political journey here. And I think that for me it sort of felt like, you know, this is the start of the end of the era. There are very few figures of that kind of standing that are still with us. To me, I felt like a huge burden of responsibility, a determination to unite the people on this island. And to me, it was fairly significant, I think, in terms of marking that sort of end of that era.
Join us after the break, where Michelle O'Neill and I discuss what a post-Brexit Northern Ireland will look like and Sinn Féin's long-term strategy for Irish unity. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. And this week, I'm speaking with Michelle O'Neill. The Northern Ireland Assembly reopened or came back into operation in January after power sharing had collapsed, as you mentioned, 3 years before that. What's your working relationship as the deputy with the First Minister of Northern Ireland, namely Arlene Foster? What's your working relationship like, the two of you, these days?
Yes, so I am joint head of government with Arlene Foster, so we hold equal office and we have a very good constructive working relationship. I think that after our politics being broken for 3 years, to come together in January, in the middle of January, and then within 2 months to be faced with the COVID pandemic has meant that we've had to work very closely at speed and build that relationship. But I think we've done, I'm quite pleased with the work we've been able to do and the relationship that we've been able to build for the betterment of the people that we serve.
Is she a tough woman to get on with?
Look, you know, we all have our own personality traits, don't we? But I think that Arlene and I have been able to strike a good working relationship, and we can have quite constructive conversations, which is necessary because we work together as that joint head of government. And, you know, it's challenging. A five-party coalition is challenging in normal political circumstances, but in our context of our special and unique part of the world, it's even more challenging to try to get it right. And sometimes we do and sometimes we don't.
You mentioned before that it is the job of all people involved now to nourish and protect the peace process that the people you've just mentioned, you know, worked so hard to establish. Do you think the UK government is doing enough to fulfil its responsibility to protect the peace in Northern Ireland?
No, I believe that the British government have been reckless with the peace process. You know, the two governments, the Irish government and the British government, are co-guarantors of our peace agreement. So it's their responsibility to demonstrate an impartiality, but also to demonstrate on an ongoing way their support for the peace process. But the British government over many, many years have just sat back, particularly from the Tories came into power, have sat back and have not fulfilled their responsibility as co-guarantor. And I think Brexit is a case in point. Brexit and the Good Friday Agreement are incompatible. And that reckless agenda ignored the wishes of the people here who voted on a cross-community way to reject Brexit. And they've ignored that time and time again. And I think that their attitude towards, for example, dealing with the past, we must deal with the past so as to not burden our young people of today with that. And I think that their one-sided approach to not properly deal with the past has been just entirely unacceptable. So, and I will continue to hold their feet to the fire for that, because that is, in fact, their job.
One of the consequences that people think might flow from Brexit and how it's being implemented, particularly this creation, in effect, of a border down the Irish Sea, is to make Northern Ireland, people of the North, closer to the rest of Ireland. And that will actually bring forward the day when people might eventually decide that their obvious destiny isn't with the United Kingdom anymore, but rather in a united Ireland. Now, one thing that people who've been following politics in Northern Ireland for a long time always say is that Sinn Féin is nothing if not strategic, and it takes very much the long view, and therefore there's always a sort of strategic plan. Sinn Féin's animating purpose is United Ireland. What is the sort of strategy that your party have for getting from here to there, given perhaps some of what I've just been saying about Brexit and how it plays out?
Brexit is the clearest demonstration of the blatant disregard that the British government have for the people here. There isn't anything good for us here in terms of Brexit. And as I said, we voted to reject Brexit, but it demonstrates for people, and not just those of a nationalist perspective or a Republican perspective, it demonstrates to all people, including those from the unionist community, that the British government do not prioritise their needs, that they're not putting their interests first. So what I want, and what our intention is to continue the debate. And I can tell you this, in my whole lifetime, I have never witnessed the level of conversation that is now underway. The discussion on Irish unity is really very much underway right across this island. And it's not just nationalists and Republicans who are talking about it. Many, many others, including those from unionist background, are entering into the conversation. And that is a really healthy, healthy, good thing. But also COVID-19, the Boris Johnson strategy in terms of COVID-19, we would have lost a lot more people to COVID-19 had the executive here not had the ability to take its own path.
I mean, you mentioned people from unionist background. Surely, even with Brexit and coronavirus and however angry they are with how Boris Johnson's government has dealt with those things, those people are not, to use your phrase, ever going to be convinced of the merits of a united Ireland, are they?
And I see it as my responsibility to talk to those people that aren't convinced, that are yet to be convinced. So I would say you could probably characterise people into a number of different groups. You're going to have your pro-United Irelanders. You're going to have people who are vehemently opposed to it. You're going to have people who are it's somewhere in the middle and not sure, but are open for the conversation. But Brexit gives you a practical example of how not to do something. There was mistruth. There was not all the information was not laid bare for people to see. And people voted for something not having all the facts. What we think needs to happen now is that now is the time to plan. It's now actually the Irish government's time to plan for unity and start to put the facts on the table. Let people understand what does an all-island health service look like? What does an all-island education service look like? We now need to populate that information, put it out there for all to see, and then let people make an informed choice. Because I believe we are now in a decade of opportunity. And I believe that over the course of the next number of years, certainly before the end of this decade, we will have voted for United Ireland. And I want us to achieve the unity referendum, but I also want us to win it. And that means that we need to have these conversations now.
It really would mean that. I mean, if you're thinking that in terms of a decade, that means a decade to persuade people who currently identify themselves as British to instead say they're happy to be, in effect, Irish. And I just wonder if that is a very big ask, and perhaps even naive to think that is achievable even within, I mean, to achievable within 10 years, even with the big mistakes that, you know, one perhaps can agree the London government are making.
I'm not trying to make anybody who has a British identity surrender that to take on an Irish identity. That's not the intention. At the heart of the Good Friday Agreement is the issue of identity. That's addressed. We have to have that continuity of those protections inbuilt into the Good Friday Agreement that follow us into a new and agreed Ireland. So we have to find a way for both Irish identity and British identity to be cherished equally. That's what I want. I don't want a United Ireland just for Republicans or Nationalists. It has to be for everybody who shares this island. So we need to make sure that everybody feels part of that, that everybody has their equal and valued part in the new society that we're trying to build. But I am certainly not for diminishing anybody's Britishness. That has to be front and centre of everything that we do as well.
And you believe that Britishness could have a place even in a united Ireland. The Tory government, Boris Johnson, have tried to sell Brexit when it comes to Northern Ireland by saying, actually, Northern Ireland might get the best of both worlds because it could have a gateway into the single market on the one hand and then, you know, frictionless trade with the rest of the United Kingdom on the other. And it's going to have this sort of best of both option. Do you buy any of that?
I don't. I think that there isn't anything good to come from Brexit. For us, either way, it involves upheaval to our way of life. We set ourselves a strategy at the start of the Brexit debate in Sinn Féin, and the strategy was to achieve, one, to say in the first chance we reject Brexit, but secondly, to achieve special status. We achieved that in the form of the Irish Protocol. That's our protection. That's our floor in the middle of the Brexit debate because we're, you know, quickly running out of road here, coming towards the end of the year. The likelihood of a deal, negotiated trade deal, is yet to be understood. It certainly doesn't look good at this moment in time. So we at least we have the protocol, which is some protection, but no, I don't think anybody here was ever convinced of the best of both worlds debate. I think what's going to be most interesting in a post-Brexit world, and I think a lot of people actually have maybe missed this point, the EU have said that in the event of a successful unity referendum, the North will automatically rejoin the EU. So for a lot of people in this decade we have in front of us, they're going to be considering which union do they wish to be part of. And the EU have offered us a route back in, and that is through the unity referendum. So for some people, it may not be about Britishness versus Irishness. It may be about do they value the European citizenship. And I think that's going to be a very interesting debate.
That is really interesting. So in other words, somebody might feel British within United Ireland, but also European all at once. And you would say, yeah, you can have all those identities. They would be protected in some kind of new United Ireland entity.
Absolutely. I think that's what I think. Because what we currently have here is a segregated society, that sectarianism is still very much part and parcel of our society. That's not good. What I think we have here is an opportunity to do something better. But it has to be an opportunity for us all, and it has to be something that we all have to grasp. And to me, that comes back to the hope and the promise of the Good Friday Agreement.
And you've given yourselves 10 years to do it. Michelle O'Neill, thanks very much for talking to Politics Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Next week, I speak to the Conservative MP Damian Green about his hopes to pull Boris Johnson back from the Tory far right and more towards the politics of One Nation Toryism.
The view of the modern One Nation caucus is that we now need to get on with life and make the best of it and make sure that the domestic policies of the UK government accord with One Nation Conservative principles.
But that's all from me this week. The producer is Daniel Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please stay safe and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.